The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
There was a Welsh poet, Dylan Thomas, and he said this, "When one burns one's bridges, what a nice fire that can make." Now, in most cases, you don't want to always burn your bridges. But I'm saying today there is a time to sometimes burn some of our bridges. There's a time to take an action from which return from that action is impossible. A time to irrevocably make a fateful and final decision. And those times come upon us in life. And I think now is the time to burn some bridges. There's a dramatic story that to me illustrates this. It was 296 AD and Constantinus Caesar wanted to retake Britain from the British provinces from Electus. And he amassed enough ships to carry thousands of troops and he finally brought them to the place where he was going to offload. He offloaded all his troops and he commanded them to march up the rocky, arduous path to the top of the mountains there, and up on top were all of the enemy, and they were watching this take place. And this Caesar marched his troops about halfway up, and he commanded them to halt. And then he said, "About face." And as they turned, they looked down on the shoreline, and there they saw their ships burning. And Caesar had set fire to his own ships that day. And every single one of those men had the spine-tingling, chilling truth enter their mind. There is no turning back. There's no food. There's no water. There is no provisions. And therefore, there was no choice. They must go forward. They must fight or die. A chilling example, isn't it? And yet, it was a powerful one, and it carries with it a very, I think, important principle for us in our Christian calling. Because we made a decision, didn't we? Every one of us made an irrevocable decision from which there was no turning back. We came to a low spot in our lives, most of us we did, and we realized that our lives were a mess. We realized that, in fact, life, in many cases, was a sham, that we had been deceived. And we realized at one point, God's way is the only real way that works. It's the only right way to live. And at that point, we made a commitment to join in God's war. We enlisted in spiritual warfare at that time. We knew we'd have to be tough on ourselves. We knew we'd have to struggle against sin, and we counted the cost. And we were baptized, and we understood it meant putting no less than ourselves to death. Everything that we were, everything that was in the past, was to be buried, and we were going to go forward, and we would deny ourselves if we had to. We became Christian soldiers in Luke 14 and verse 25. Verse 26, let's pick it up there. "If anyone comes to me," Jesus says, "and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brother and sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever doesn't bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." And then he says, "For which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it, lest after he's laid the foundation, and he's not able to finish it, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build, but he wasn't able to finish.' Or what king going to make war against another king does not sit down first and consider whether he's able with 10,000 to meet him who comes with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and he asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has, or isn't willing to forsake all that we have, cannot be my disciple," he says. So we are at a war, and we are in a war that sometimes gets tough, and sometimes there's pulls on us, and sometimes it can be painful. When those times occur, do we want to sue for conditions of peace? Do we want to rebuild the bridge? Do we ever want to go back to the way it was? Sometimes I think we do. Exodus 14. I think God was probably the first one to use this kind of principle of burning bridges. He called Israel out of Egypt, Exodus 14. And when he did, he knew that it was possible that they might weaken. And so God didn't take any chances with them. He didn't make any provision for them to ever be able to go back. So he led them along this route to the Red Sea. Pharaoh goes after them, and in like manner, of course, Pharaoh goes after us, doesn't he? He wants to get us to sin when we are trying to leave it behind. And so we see this example here in Exodus 14 and verse 10. Exodus 14 and verse 10, "And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And then they said to Moses, 'Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Isn't this the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, "Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians"? For we would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness." And so the Israelites, they wanted to cave in. They wished they could have not left. They were thinking in terms of going back to sin. Moses tells them that God will help them in verse 13. Moses said to the people, "Don't be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians who you see today, you shall see them no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." And the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward." That is the message of the last day of unleavened bread. As we understand, that was the day they went through the Red Sea. And that's the theme of that day. And that's the theme for us in the period we're in now. To go forward. Don't look back. Don't want to go back. But go forward and burn those bridges behind, as it were. In verse 21 through 23, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night. And he made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. And so the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on the right hand and on their left. And as we've seen from videos and so on, that this is probably about 400 to 600 feet of water. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen. And now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians, took off their chariot wheels, so they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." And the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians on their chariots and on their horsemen." And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. And when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. And the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. And not so much of one of them remained. What an incredible example that this was. Just incredible. God destroyed the great Egyptian army, the most powerful army. He had destroyed all of their crops, didn't he? And he destroyed all of their animals practically, didn't he, with the plagues. And now he had taken the firstborn, and usually the firstborn are the cream of the crop. They're usually the high achievers. He destroyed everything about Egypt before it was over. He broke the back of the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. Why? And why open the sea and then close it again? Because it was the same principle that Caesar used. He wanted every bridge burned so there was nothing to go back to. And that's an example for us. We should cut our lives off from all those things that lead to sin, that are in our past. So he did that for them. But I ask us today, what about us? Romans 13. Remember this, that they, it says in the scriptures in 1 Corinthians, all those things were written for us, upon whom the ends of the age have come. And so they are written for us. Could we get distracted like they did? Because it wasn't long after then, was it? Remember in Exodus 16? It wasn't long after that that they wanted to go back again. It was 1 month later, in the second month, on the 15th day of the month, they cried out, and they said almost the same words. We could have died there. Why bring us out here? And they were thinking of what? The flesh pots, weren't they? They were thinking of the bread that they had. They were thinking about those things that appealed to their flesh and that they were missing now, and there were pressures on them, and that was driving them to look back and to wish they could go back. How much different are we today? We've left sin behind. We're in a spiritual war. We're wandering in the wilderness of spiritual sin, aren't we? Yes. How about the things we left behind? How much pull do they have on us today? How attractive are they to you and to me? Paul understood, and he wrote to those at the end this, in Romans 13, where we left off in the last sermon, in verse 11. Romans 13, in verse 11, and do this, he says, knowing that the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep, for now our salvation is nearer than when we first believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. He's talking about the people at the end, the people who would see these things that happened to Israel, the things that they were written for. We're those people. Therefore, he says, let us cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in licentiousness and lewdness, not in strife and envy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. So we're to wake up. We at the end, as we get closer, are told to wake up. But we're also to do something else, aren't we? It says to be on guard and to be fearlessly honest, he says. Not to be a party people, not to be drinking, and not to be, in the King James it says, not to be involved in wantonness or chambering, and that is, he's speaking of spiritual, not spiritual, but sexual, I'm sorry, abuses and excesses, fornication and adultery, and we're to avoid strife and not be contentious and arguing all the time. And we're not to be filled with envy, and we're not to be like we were in the past, because we were driven. We're part of a materialistic society. We were, as that song says, constant craving, always wanting more. Don't want those things. Leave those behind. Cut them off. Burn the bridges, as it were, Galatians 3. And so he says that we're to put on Jesus Christ. And we have to do that first. Galatians 3. I'm working with this new Bible here. Pages are kind of sticking together. Galatians 3 and verse 26. So how do we put on Jesus Christ? Verse 26 of chapter 3, for you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ, you've put on Christ. And so we have been immersed in the Holy Spirit, been baptized and buried the old man, and that old man dies. And then the one that comes up now, filled with the Spirit of God, has the mind of Christ in us. And Paul explains this a little more clearly back in Galatians 2 and verse 20, where he says, I have been crucified with Christ, but it's no longer I who live, but then Christ lives in me, and the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and who gave himself for me. And so we don't live by our own faith anymore, do we? It's not what we believe, it's what he believes inside us. It's his values, his standards. We now have access to the very thoughts and the mind of God. And so he then lives his life in us. And by so doing, we're able to leave those things behind because we've put on Jesus Christ. I know a lot of people have talked about this, and I have kind of made comments about being a put-on. But it actually talks about being clothed with him in another place, and it says to put on Jesus Christ in another place. And isn't that kind of how it begins? When we first are called and converted, we know what the truth is, but we're so used to other habits, and we kind of have to act like we think Christ would act. But eventually, as we keep doing that, what happens? It no longer becomes something we're forcing ourselves to do, no longer something we're making ourselves do. It becomes what we are. It becomes our habit. It becomes our way of life. His way of life becomes ours. And we begin to imitate him and be more like him as we go on in our lives. And so it is that we use that spirit and we use that mind of Christ to navigate through life and make the decisions that you and I make. And as we're doing this, Paul says, don't make provisions for the flesh. So we're going through life. We've got now the pulls of the Spirit pulling us this way. We've got the pulls of the flesh in this direction, don't we? Like Paul says. There's this spiritual warfare going on. Well, what's going to happen is if we make provision for the flesh, then it's going to have a lot of weight on which side is going to pull us in our life. And so what did he mean when he said, don't make provision for the flesh? What did he mean when he said that? The Greek word for provision is pronoio. And it means to take thought of. And it means really like an afterthought. In other words, we're not to rethink the past. We're not to kind of think and long and replay the files that we have in our head and long for those things that are those that we left behind. It's like the man, that is making provision for the flesh, or like the man who went on a diet. And he went to work one day and he brought 24 donuts in to work with him. Well, the people at work knew he was on a diet and they said, what in the world are you doing bringing 24 donuts in here? And he said, well, I was praying to God on the way to work and I asked him, I said, if it's your will that I buy some donuts, then I would have to see a sign, and I would have to see a parking place right in front of that crowded donut shop open for me. And he said, there it was, an opening right there, after driving around the block 8 times. Well, you understand the point. He was making sure there would be a place open. He was forcing the issue, kind of cheating a little there. But what he was doing was making provision for the flesh, making sure that the flesh would have what it wanted. A clear case of this. Caesar made sure there was no provision for the flesh because they might have wanted to run. Made sure there was no place to run. Christ made sure with those people he took out of Egypt, there's no way to make provision for the flesh because I'm wiping it out. There's no way to go back. Let's go to Ephesians 5, if you will. Ephesians 5. It all kind of begins right here, right inside you and me. And so Paul realized the kind of the heart of the problem here, Ephesians 5 and verse 29. The scripture that very few people ever read, but I'm going to read it today, verse 29. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as the Lord does the church. So it starts right inside ourselves. We have an innate love of the self. And so we spend vast amount of time, don't we, taking care of the self. We spend time sometimes pampering ourselves. Sometimes we obsess on ourselves, in fact, in life. It's vast amounts of money. So we worry about how much weight we carry. We worry about are we still attractive. We worry about how much hair we have. And we worry about how much money we have in the bank. And so we go to work every day to make sure that we have the things we need. And so we're providing for the flesh, and that's natural, isn't it? We'll save up money to buy something we want. Those are natural inclinations and a natural way of just providing for ourselves. The problem is it can careen totally out of control because of our human nature. And one of the places I would say that you can see this almost all the time, where it gets wild sometimes, is in government or in corporate budgeting. Have you ever noticed this, what happens? In almost every case you'll see in these corporations, they have a plan in which at the end of the year, they're going to budget for the next year. And so the department heads do what? In the beginning of the year, they go very carefully by the budget. But by the end of the year, if they've got any money left, what do they end up doing? They've got to spend it as fast as they can. Why? So that they can get another budget the same amount. If they don't spend all their money, their budget's going to be less for the next year. So they want their budget to be the same amount. So they spend it, and they'll spend it on crazy things. It's amazing. Remember the time Almanac wrote this about the U.S. government. Government departments go on a spending spree at the end of each fiscal year to get rid of every cent that Congress has authorized them to pay out. As a result, the government now has built a 10-year stockpile of office furniture that is being stored in warehouses in which they must spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to pay rent on. It's bizarre, isn't it? But what are they doing? Well, they're making provision for the flesh because they don't want to get caught. They don't want to have to make any sacrifices. I think one of the supreme examples that most of us are familiar with in this is the case of Imelda Marcos. Everybody remembers that she had a stockpile of shoes. There were 4,000 shoes in her closet, it was said. And they were taking money out of the Philippines and sending it into American bank accounts. And eventually they amassed $220 million that they had in American banks. It said that that she went once on a fabulous shopping spree in New York and she spent $20 million in 1 month. They say $15,000 was spent before the plane touched the ground over phone orders. It was $10,000 a day in petty shopping, just in shopping. Can you imagine that? That would be fun. Millions on a co-op apartment that was 3 stories high and it had 22 rooms, 9 baths, had a 55-foot ballroom with 35-foot ceilings in it, and all of this, $2.3 million for jewelry. All of this was doing what? What was she doing? Making provisions for the flesh. I mean, she was an important person and she had to have what other important people had. And so, in the meantime, her people were very, very well, not well off. They were really struggling in her country. And instead of serving them, it was about serving herself. So you can see that, can't you? It's clear. We can see what's going on there. My question today is, can we see it happening in our lives? What about us? And what about sin? When it comes to sin, do we make provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof? I think I mentioned this case. I'll mention it again for the sake of the tape. And that was, I talked to an individual once, and we were just chatting, and they told me they were backing off prayer and Bible study. I said, what in the world are you backing off prayer and Bible study for? And they said, because I feel I need to leave my spouse. I'm going to get a divorce and I can't really do it. It just hurts my conscience too much. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to back off prayer and study until my conscience doesn't bother me. Then I can get the divorce. And once I get that, then I can come back to God and pray and study again and get close to God again. But you understand what we're talking about. We're talking about making provision for what the flesh wants to do. And we do it deliberately in many cases. Make an outward conscious decision to do this. I remember another story, and I'll tell you this, from what I've talked to people, this is not an uncommon story. A spouse wants to go out and drink. They know they really shouldn't go out to a bar and drink, but they want to do it. The pressures are building up on the flesh. So what the spouse does, comes home, finds something wrong in the family, starts an argument, and then they're able to get mad and in a huff drive off and go have a few drinks. And not only that, they can blame the spouse. It's a beautiful system, isn't it? But what are they doing? Making provision. It's a conscious decision and sometimes subconscious decision, but they're providing ways to get what it is they want. And so it's a case of we need in our life sometimes a reason to do what we think is wrong, a justification, don't we? So we manufacture the reason, and I've seen this many times. I remember I worked for this guy in the one company, and he was a pretty good-sized drinker, I would say. But what was interesting was, you understand the point, the company would have a job, and it would go in the tank. It would be a real loser. Well, we had to have a drink over that, so we'd have a bottle of wine over that because, you know, it was such a bad job. Then we'd have a job that was a success, and we'd make lots of money. Well, I had to celebrate. So we always had our reasons, didn't we, to do what we want to do. I remember I was a young man, I smoked, and it was really bothering me. I know it doesn't bother some people, but in my case, I actually would wake up in the morning coughing so bad I had to hold on to the door. So I must have an allergy or something to it. But I just, I'm telling you, I couldn't stop smoking. I mean, the best I'd get would be 4 days. So I had this, it happened over and over and over. I would get 4 days, the pressure would build up so much on me, I would go to a bar and have a few drinks. Because after a few drinks, I could buy a pack, and it really couldn't be held accountable, right? But you see the point, what I was doing? I was making provision, wasn't I? I knew what I needed to do to get what I really wanted, and I just went ahead and did it. Concerted, deliberate effort to do it. What I think is funny sometimes, and of course it's not funny, but I've talked to a number of people that were chronic drinkers, and they have some of the best stories because they'll get in trouble with their drinking, and so they'll promise everyone, I'm not going to drink anymore. But they have to make provision for the flesh, so what they'll do is they'll hide it. Have you ever heard some of those stories? They have some incredible places. I remember one hid in the attic, another one had places in the garage, and this lady had to always go to the garage to get something, and the husband always wondered why. Other people, I have ingenious ideas sometimes, I think, was to put the bottle actually in the tank of the toilet back there. And one story was told of using a Geritol bottle because they had these brown, dark bottles, and no one needed Geritol. They wouldn't go in there, but the dark bottle would hide what was in there, and so they could hide it that way. Another case, the last case is, I remember counseling with a couple, and the man said that he had to have HBO because there were so many interesting programs on there, and his wife said, well, yeah, but what he does is he's watching these ladies that are on there, and they're mostly not dressed, and she said, I complain, and I don't like that, but he insists he has to have HBO because of the other movies that we like to watch together. But the point was, you understand, he was making sure he had the cable hooked up so he could be surfing and just, accidentally land on the channel. Making provision for the flesh. And that's what Paul is saying we shouldn't do. So we look at those cases, we see those, but I'm asking us today, what about us? Do we ever do this? One writer put it this way. I say it's time to burn the bridge. This person says, if you tolerate sin in your life, that sin will not only take you farther than you wanted to go, it will keep you longer than you wanted to stay, and it will cost you more than you thought you'd pay. Wow, that's insightful, isn't it? Let's go to James 1, where it talks about this enticing process and how it works. James 1, James, Peter, and John. Fascinating insight here. You think the people back there didn't have wisdom? They weren't smart? I think this is brilliant the way James writes this. Verse 13, let no one say when he's tempted that I'm tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when the desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. Don't be deceived, my beloved brethren. Yes, but we can easily be deceived. The temptation is always there. At first, it's just a mere thought. Slowly it enters the mind, doesn't it? It's a thought. Then the imagination begins to work. And we romance the thought. And the imagination begins to strengthen the colors, to deepen the thought, as it were. And it becomes to a point where it seems better than it actually is. And then, what if we've made provision for it? What if we have it around? What if we know where it is? What if we know where we can go to get it? It's overwhelming, the chances are we're going to give our assent. Isn't it? Yes. So the point I make today is we'll fall for it. We'll do the same sin again and again, and we'll blame someone else. We'll blame the circumstances. We'll have a reason, we'll have a justification, won't we? As one man said, every snowflake in the avalanche claims, I'm not guilty. It's like us, isn't it? The deacon once took me backpacking, and I'll be forever grateful for that. I'm not a mountain man, of course. I like five-star hotels. But it was a wonderful, rich experience. I'd never been fly fishing, and we had to fish for our food. And it was fascinating to me because I've been off the boats or off the pier, and you drop your line, and maybe you get some tugs, and you reel in your fish. Fly fishing was so different. It was really fascinating to me. It was quite an experience. I could see the fish I wanted there in the stream. The melted water had come down. It was just crystal clear, and you could look right through and see the rock over there about 15 feet away on the other side. There's the fish you want. And so you carefully make a fly out of feathers or hair or something. And sometimes what we did was we would catch insects and use them. And so I would take that fly, and you just take that, and you try to get it right over as close to the fish as you can. You want to get it right in front of them so it looks like the fly just, oh, landed in the water. And then you tease the fish. You have to tease the fish, and you kind of wiggle it a little bit, and you make it attractive. And sometimes the fish just ignores it like it could care less, like you were even there. But you know, you try it again, and you try it again until you can seduce the fish. You actually have to seduce him into it. And then they finally can't take it anymore. The bait looks delicious. It looks big and lush and juicy. That fly grabs it, and pow, he's caught. And instead of satisfaction, the fish gets what? Death. And that's the game that is being played with us. Satan is the angler. He's got lots of angles, doesn't he? And he's fishing for us, and he wants to catch us, and he wants to get us nailed. And so it's something we got to watch out for, this thing called sin. Matthew 18. Matthew 18, if you will. Only we knew, if only we could see how dangerous it is, how deeply ugly and sinister it all is, how premeditated it is, perhaps we'd be more careful then. It wouldn't make the provision for the sin. As Christ said, we should avoid all the things that cause us to sin. Avoid them is what he says, doesn't it? I remember there was a skit that was on Hee Haw, forgive me. I didn't watch it, actually. I just read this. Anyway, one of the men came to the dock on the show Hee Haw, and he said, Doc, I broke my arm in two places. What should I do? And he said, the doc said, don't go to those places. Funny, isn't it? Matthew 18, verse 7. Woe to the world because of offenses, for offenses must come. But woe to the man by whom the offenses come. And if your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It's better for you to enter into life lame or maimed, rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into everlasting fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It's better for you to enter into life with one eye than having two eyes to be cast into hell fire. And of course, Christ isn't telling us to literally cut pieces of our body off. He's making a comparison. It would be better if you did this rather than miss out. But the point is, if something is causing you to sin, you've got to cut it out of your life. I've got to cut it out of my life. It's better to cut these things out. But think how much this applies to those things in our lives that lead us to sin. What about them? What are the things in our lives that lead us to sin? What are the things in our lives that enable us to sin and fulfill the lusts of the flesh? Are there things that we keep around that enable us? Are there friends? Are there shops? Are there videos? Alcohol or drugs or something like that we keep around our house? Or are there places like bars or other friends' homes that we know of where we can go and where we will have a part in sin that might take place? If there is, if we know about it, are we making provision for the flesh? 1 Corinthians 10. I ask us to consider it today and look at these scriptures. We're going to run through a few briefly here. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13, where it says, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry." Well, it is idolatry, 1 Corinthians 6. It is idolatry if we keep something stashed and we're making provision for it so we can sin later. It is idolatry. And then in 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 18, it says this. I'm sorry, in verse 18, is it? "Flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body. But he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body." The King James has fornication in there. And I say today, and I ask us to think about this in this context, fornication isn't always the literal act of sinning that way physically. Because Jesus said, if we look at a woman to lust after her, we've committed adultery in our heart. I'm saying today, if you look at a woman who's not married, and you have the idea in your mind, you're thinking about sex with that person, it is committing fornication in a spiritual sense today. And I say this in the context of the internet, because in the case of the internet today, every single man is only one click away from fornication. The porn industry is absolutely rampant. And is it something that we might make provision for? Because it says flee fornication. Don't make it provision for it. I say burn the bridge today. Paul says, wake up. Let's burn that bridge behind us. 1 Timothy 6. What about money today? It's a big issue. We're in a materialistic society and everybody thinks you have. I mean, it's amazing today. Young people today think they get married and they're expected to have a brand new cars and nice places to live, and hardly anybody thinks they need to make a sacrifice. But today we have this vision that we should have more. Everybody should have more, and then we should have these big homes and nice cars and all these things. And it's presented to us through advertising over and over and over. We're assaulted by it. And so people want easy money. And today there's an industry that I think abets this, and it's the lotto. For example, there was a case, I did some reading once in the LA Times. There was a man who had entirely papered the walls of his house with lotto tickets. He had spent dozens of thousands of dollars trying to make money so he could live like he sees the other people living. And he probably could have invested that money and done fairly well. But you understand my point, that I think that there are these demands on us, these pressures on us, to conform to our society. And what we need to do is realize that we must not be covetous this way. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 6. "Godliness with contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into this world, and it's certain we can carry nothing out." Well, there is one thing you can carry out, isn't there? Character of God. The mind of God. "And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into a temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." And so, what about doctrinally? How about argument? Remember it said strife and debate and all of that? You know, it's funny that I see sometimes in the church today that we'll have cases where people will have their special scriptures, an arsenal of them for their particular doctrine, and that they will lead the conversation around so that they will have an opportunity to talk about, bring out their arsenal, and then they can start arguing and debate. And some of this is just to be superior. I mean, we love talking about the Bible, and iron sharpens iron. It's not a problem talking about the Bible or different views and so on. But my point is, I've seen it out there in the churches of God before, where it's a matter of, I know this and you don't. And we have an arsenal of scriptures, and it's vanity, it's egotism, and it's misplaced. But you understand, what's the arsenal for? Well, I'm making provision for the lusts of the flesh. And so it is that we have all of these things that we need to fight with. 2 Timothy 2, all of these things are pulls on us in this modern age, at the end of the age that we live in. 2 Timothy 2, and verse 22. Flee youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness. Do you see the scriptures I've read? Everyone, flee, avoid. Don't do it. Cut it out. Flee youthful lusts, which I don't have to worry about too much now that I'm an old fool here. Flee youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. But avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they just gender strife. And so the servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all and able to teach patiently, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition, if God will perhaps grant them repentance so that they may know the truth. And so the approach then is to not be striving, not fighting, not clashing with one another in the church of God. So we don't want to get caught in any of these things. And so for that reason, Paul says, don't make provision for the flesh. So to do that, he says, be fearlessly honest. It says, don't be a party person, don't be drunken, don't be chambering and wantonness, speaking of sexual excess, sins of fornication and adultery, to avoid strife and so on, and not be filled with envy, as I said, constantly craving. And this is the challenge in the age that we live in, at the end of the age. And so today I speak to you, because you want to be awake. That's what you want. So I'm asking us today to look within. Is there any possible way that we might be making provision for the flesh in our lives? Well, I say there is. Of course there is. We're all human, so to one degree or another, I believe that we do this. Sometimes it's just on small levels. But I'm asking us to honestly ask ourselves, are we doing this? Let's at least take a look. And if we find that there is something we've been doing, let's put it behind us and let's move on. Let's go forward. Let's burn that bridge like the ships in the harbor there that Caesar burned. So there was no provision for going back. Let's go forward and let's not look back and no longer make provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the message beneficial. If you would like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we would like to hear from you. You may contact us at 1-800-723-6108. We also invite you to visit our website at eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.